This conversation with Iona Dare took place at her home in Moscow on February 24, 1977. Her sister, Bernadine Adair Cornelison, also took part in the conversation. The interviewer was Sam Schrager.
I'm wondering why there were so many women here.
Why the women went out there?
Yeah.
Well, in the first place, the locator out through that part of the country had a wife that wanted a timber claim, a sister that wanted a timber claim, two sisters that wanted timber claims, and there was a couple of women here in town that wanted timber claims that we all knew. So when the locator had located this particular batch of timber out in what was called the 49 Meadow Country, and he took this bunch out to show them the country and the timber, and if they wanted to locate, then we could all locate there within a certain distance of each other. Practically a little colony by themselves. So that's the way we all happened to go out there. And I joined the bunch of Mrs. Torreson and Mrs. Durham and Mrs. Taylor and Winifred Calkins and Kip Calkins and following us when we located out there was Irwin Hansen, and Art Larson went out with him just to be on the homestead with him so he'd have company. And they were on one side. And they were 4 miles and a half off on one side. And Mrs. Torreson was in 3/4 of a mile.
That was a colony.
Mrs. Durham's. And my homestead was about 4 miles over on the other side, and Mrs. Taylor's was over that way. And so we all got together just as a group and would take our trips out together.
Huh.
And it was a saving on packers and so forth when we all went together. That was, what else?
Ask him.
Were most of these ladies as self-reliant as you were? These women?
I didn't quite hear you.
Well, it seemed like to be a homesteader, it took a lot of self-reliance. You know, you had to depend on yourself and your own resources.
You had to depend upon yourself. But these others, of course, surrounding you that were homesteaders or that took up homesteaders all helped if you needed any help or anything like that. And Mrs. Durham and I planned the winter together. I was 4 miles and a half from her place, and so we decided that she and her daughter and I would live together that winter, and I would go back and forth to my place as I wished. And it was all snowshoeing, of course, mostly, and that's the way we traveled. Then my father was afraid that something might happen and that we'd have no means of getting word out to the outside of an emergency. So he and Mrs. Durham and I decided that we'd hire a man to stay with us that winter. And so my father made the arrangements with a man by the name of Carter, and Bill Carter said that he would trap that winter and would try to make up for any additional expenses that he was due or needed, and that he would go out once a month anyway to get the mail and bring it to us. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the time he would spend trapping in that part of the country.
Was he staying at the same cabin with that you and
just Mrs. Durham and her daughter and I? We were the three that were together. And Mrs. Terson, who was a miller here in town, had a cabin about 3/4 mile from our place, but she only spent the summers out there. Let her sister run the business here in town, and she went out and spent it on the homestead while the weather was good.
Oh, I was just wondering, did he when he was there, did he have to sleep in the barn, or was there, or could he sleep in the house? Or there was no barn there. He could sleep in the house too then.
He slept in the house with us, yes. We had, I don't know whether you know bear grass or not, but it's a very wiry grass and holds up when you make a mattress of it. And we made him a full-size mattress for, he was over 6 feet tall. We made a full-size mattress for him of this, and each day we would roll it up, put a blanket over it, and it could be used as a seat in case that you wanted extra accommodation.
Just a mat of bear grass? Mm-hmm. It was just a mat of bear grass?
Just a mattress of bear grass. We made the mattress out of gunny sacks that we had, and then cut the bear grass and made the mattress for him. And that was his bedroom. And we had a bedroom across the end of the cabin. And I had a single bed, and Mrs. Durham and her daughter had a double bed. And during the daytime, we had fixed them so they would, the double bed would fold up in the wall and out of the way. And the single bed was used as a seat during the daytime.
Didn't you have an attic in that place, a second
yes,
story?
Yes, we had an attic in
it
the
fell
place.
Out of it or something.
And that's where we kept flour and sugar or things that the moisture might affect. We had an outdoor cellar, and we kept the canned goods in this outdoor cellar. But the upper was the attic. We kept the flour and the sugar because that would be warm from the heat in the cabin and it wouldn't get solid. Carter one day got everything all ready to go out for the mail and left early in the morning, for it was, they called it 28 miles out to Avery by trail. And he didn't go back into Clarkia because that was a longer route. It took 45 miles to get in that way. So he went out the short way to Avery, and the mail was all sent to Avery, and he would go out and get it. Well, he got everything all ready and left early. And after he left, Mrs. Durham decided that she had to wash, and the extra soap and stuff she needed was up in the attic. And the only way into the attic was by ladder and a trap door. So we brought in the ladder and opened the trap door, and Mrs. Durham went up to the attic to get the flour or whatever it was that she needed. And about the time she got up there, the ice on the legs of the ladder broke off, and the ladder went down. Mrs. Durham went with it, and as she went down, she hit the end of her spine on the ladder and dropped off in a faint. Well, Myrtle and I didn't know what to do, so we just grabbed up a bottle of camphor that was there and intending to put it under her nose or where she breathed it, and Myrtle miscalculated and put it on her eye, on her forehead. It run down into her eye. Well, That brought Mrs. Durham to in one grand rush. We grabbed her while she was in that condition and put her over on my bed. And she lay there all afternoon just moaning, "Oh, my tailbone, oh, my tailbone." It nearly drove us crazy because we didn't know what to do about it until Carter got back anyway. We couldn't send word out. We couldn't do anything. And we neither one of us were going off and leaving the other one alone with the mother on a 28-mile trip out to town. So we just endured moaning and tried to keep her as comfortable as possible. When Carter got back then, he could see that Mrs. Durham was in a very bad condition and we would have to be taken out to town. And so we waited for about a week until she got to feeling a little better. And then Carter took her and started out to Avery as a 28-mile trip for a woman with her tailbone injured and on snowshoes. So she got along very nicely until about the last mile and a half or 2 miles of the trip, and then she broke down. She just couldn't go any farther, so Carter practically carried her on in to Avery, and then they got transportation from Avery on the train and brought her down to Tico and on into Moscow. So we had her in the hospital for quite a little while here after that till she began to get better. Well, Myrtle and I were then left alone with just Carter as companion. And so we got along very nicely, but the next time Carter went out to Avery to see how Mrs. Durham was getting along, and it left Myrtle and I alone, and we were sitting eating our breakfast one morning, and the cabin door opened, and in walked a grizzly, funny-looking little old fellow. And he said, "Oh, you're here." We said, "Yes, who are you?" He said, "I'm Dynamite." And I said, "You are?" He said, "Yes, they all call me Dynamite." He said, "I'm working on the railroads and on the tunnels, and I do the drilling for the holes and putting the dynamite in, and that's where I got my name." Well, I said, "You do have another name, don't you?" And he said, "Yes, I'm Joel Chandler Harris." And he said, "My mother thought the name of Joel Chandler sounded very nice. She'd been reading about him, and so she called me Joel Chandler Harris." Well, he came in, and he stayed. He said, I'll stay here until your man gets back." So he stayed. We couldn't say get out. We had no means of putting him out or anything. And so we said, all right. So he took the bed and unrolled the bed that night, and that was his bed until Carter got back. Well, when Carter got back, then Dynamite left and went over to Larson and Hansen's cabin. And he spent the greater part of the winter at the Larson and Hansen cabin. But he was a funny-looking little fellow with whiskers all over.
Was he staying there?
We were so surprised. He said, "I've been living in your cabin while you were gone." We said we knew somebody had been there, but we had no idea who nor what. We said, "I've been there." But he said, "When your man gets back, I'll go on over to the boys." And that's what he did.
Was he staying there to protect you? Was that the idea?
Huh?
Was he staying there to protect you? Was that his thinking?
We don't know. We don't know what his idea was. He's just looking for a place to land. And he saw the place was vacant, and he just landed. And so we did a lot of blanket washing and all when we got Patrick left us.
You know, he stayed at Elsie Files' place too.
Yes,
because I know Carol Brink once mentioned that to me, that she mentioned this guy Dynamite.
She spoke about Dynamite
yes,
too, did she?
Yes, she did.
Well, Elsie was a course on what they call another branch of the Little North Bar called the Floodwood. It went south and east.
Mm-hmm.
It went south and east, and the Potlatch went the other way. And we were on the other side of the ridge from Elsie. She was quite a character. You should have known her.
She was delightful.
She certainly was. One night we were going on the trip. My father, after I'd been out there so long, the government decided I had to come in to a trial at Wallace. And in order to get to the trial at Wallace, I had to be notified to get out there. And there was no one in this part of the country that knew where I was or the location or anything. And so my father undertook to come out and notify me, which he did. And he left word that we would need a packer to bring us out. And he walked out that 25 miles from Avery, or 28 miles, and told me that I had to come in for the trip. And so they got the packer out, and the packer, Ira McPeak, lived at Clarkia, and he had been packing things for us so that he knew where we were and how to get to us and so forth. And he brought the horses out for us. And he brought a horse out for me to ride that an Indian had owned. And he lost the race for the Indian. And the Indian was so mad that he cut the horse's tail off and his ears right close to his head. Well, the day that we started out with the pack train, after my father got there, they put me on Jim, the horse, or...
Bob.
What was he?
Bob. You called the horse Bob.
Bob, because of his bob ears and his bob tails. And McPeak said, "You ride Bob because he is so sure-footed." And he said, "You ride out on Bob." Well, I had taken cold a little while before, and I was subject to attacks of quinsy. And so they dolled me up in everything they could find in the cabin. It was warm. And I mounted Bob, and we started off. Well, there's one place that we used to call Little Lake Thelma. It's a different name than that now on the maps. And I don't know what it's called now. But at any rate, you had to go up a very high, a very steep ridge to get up to the top and come on over into the Clarkia country. And we always, in going up, hung on to our horse's tail and made the horse pull us up instead of riding, because it was this way. It was so rough you couldn't ride comfortably on it. We always held on to the horse's tail. Well, I was on Bob, which had neither ears nor tail, and so I had to stay on the horse. And I'd been having the quinsy at the cabin, and it was not in a very good condition to be riding out there anyway. But we got to the, what was called the, not the company, it was the halfway cabin, it was the government cabin. And they had blankets and cooking utensils and heating and so forth at the cabin. We got to the cabin that night, and who was at the cabin but Elsie Vile. She had heard that...
Anybody home?
Yes. I always give you a recording. Did we come again? Did you understand me?
So you... You met...
Who was he?
Was Edith. She was across the street.
Oh, across the street.
So Elsie Fyle was there?
Elsie Fyle had heard through the... Well, I suppose it'd be the wireless, that the McPete was coming out to our place, and she wanted to come out to Clarkia. So she walked from her place and down to this government cabin because she knew we'd stop there. And she had with her a great big bulldog. And she, that was for protection on her cabin, but she had this big bulldog. Well, she was at the cabin that night when we got in, and I had this enormous head of hair, and that rain had wet the neck of the turtleneck sweater I was wearing, and the sweater was wet, and we couldn't get out of the sweater. So McPeak took one side, the packer took one side, Elsie took the other, and they took my hair down and the skinned this turtleneck sweater up over my head until they finally got it off and I was made as comfortable as possible. Well, Elsie and I slept in one bed that night, just the little bunk beds in the government cabin, and along in the night came the pack rats, and the bulldog didn't like pack rats, so he started chasing him all around the house, in the cabin, all around the floor, and whenever the pack rat would be, the dog would get too close, the pack rat would up onto the bed, and the dog up after him. You can imagine how much sleep went on in that cabin that night. We couldn't calm the dog down on account of the rats. And we couldn't catch the rats, and he couldn't catch the rats.
Couldn't just kick him out of the cabin?
Couldn't chase him out. They didn't have any idea of going out of the cabin.
The dog?
The dog?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was cold, snow deep outside. You don't put a dog out in the snow and leave him, especially a short-haired dog like a bulldog. But we got up the next morning and went on in to Clarkia, and Elsie took the dog and went with us, and we all got to Clarkia safe. But that was quite a trip that time.
Your father had come out all that distance by snowshoe? Had he snowshoed out to the cabin?
Yes, snowshoes or
walking.
Which
is amazing because he was not an athletic person, but determined.
Well, when you got to Clarkie, you still had a long ways to go to Wallace. Did you get on the train there?
No.
You had horses.
I had a long ways to go. Yes, my father stayed there and with me for two or three days until I got my throat cleared out. And then we went on up to Wallace and got there in time for the trial. The difficulty was that the railroad had placed, entries, had filed on a lot of this, what was supposed to be railroad land in that section of the country, and they were given by the government certain townships and certain, Well,
sections.
They had their rights.
Sections.
The railroads had rights over certain townships in order to settle up this part of the country. And some of those railroads, townships, or filings, were over on my place, and part of them were on Mrs. Cockins' place. So we all had to go in for the government hearing at Wallace. but we could take the train from Tico and make connections and get up to Wallace for the train.
Did you win that time?
No.
You lost that?
I lost it. I lived there for 22 months or more and fought the fire and fed the firemen with the help and made the trips back and forth. But I lost it. We did the best we could, and Bertnell French was a representative from Idaho back at Washington, D.C., and Burton tried his best to have it reopened and a new man put on, but they said no, that it wasn't, that it was, that I was over on the other, my location had gone over, and that I hadn't lived out there a sufficient length of time. They sent out one of these little, we call them patent leather men from Washington, D.C., and patent leather shoe men that didn't know a darn thing about timber or living in the woods.
Or women.
Or even living. And he'd come in, he'd look over your little cabin and say, it's not a suitable habitation. And I had a little garden patch, and I'd raised radishes and lettuce out there, and all. He looked at my garden patch and says, it's not sufficient cultivation for a...
And did he say that to your face?
Yes.
Huh? To your face?
Yeah, oh yes. He didn't hear. He didn't mind telling us. Well, that went on like that. He came in and he got Mrs. Durham and Mrs. Torrison's place and my place and Kip Cockin's place right next to mine where she was located on one end of the meadow and I was at the other end of the meadow. Our cabins were quite close, so I had company out there. And she lost hers. And I don't know, there's a whole bunch of them in through there that lost it on account of this man from Washington, D.C. that didn't think people could live under those conditions, although we were living under them. Well, during the fire season of 1910, this same man was put in charge of a firefighters brigade that was sent out into that part of the country. And at that time, he had sent his report in to Washington, D.C., and they'd canceled all of our homesteads out there, but we were still on the homesteads because we didn't know but what it might be open or reopened at any time. You never know when they were fighting it. And he was put on in charge of the firefighting brigade that was sent out into that section of the country. And one morning, Mrs. Taylor, who lived alone about a mile and a half or 2 miles from Mrs. Cockin's place, and she was a little uneasy about the smoke that had been drifting into the country, so she came over to stay with me and so as not to be alone at her cabin in case anything should happen. Well, we were there was a rap at the door, and it was just barely daylight outside, and Mrs. Taylor got up and answered the door, and there was this man who had reported all of these homesteaders standing at the door, and he said that he was in charge of a firefighting crew and that they were trying to locate the fire which was causing all the smoke in this part of the country. And he wanted to know if there was a trail any farther east. So she told him of her trail that went farther east, and he said he'd take his crew and go over there. Well, we got up and dressed and decided that we'd walk over and see if they had found her cabin and if they were still there, which they were when we got there. And the men that were camping around the fire on the outside, some of them, and some of them were inside of the cabin, and were trying to get something for breakfast. And Mrs. Taylor said that she would help the men. So she got busy and fixed pancakes and things for the men inside the cabin and outside the cabin. And when they went to move on then to locate farther to locate the fire, Mr. Roach said to Mrs. Taylor, wouldn't you ladies like to go on with us a little farther and get a meal for us at noon so we'd have something to eat? And we said we would. And so we followed the